Data Report, CIT 89.5 FM. We're going to be talking, we hope, shortly with Portia Karegeya about an assassination that took place in South Africa a little more than a year ago. I'll remind you, on Wednesday, on the 25th at 24 Main Street in Hamilton at the New Vision United Church, there's going to be a lecture on the American sniper, its significance with reference to Islamophobia, militarization, privatization in the military, and the glamorizing of elite corps and such matters. And Zafar Benkash and Phil Taylor are the talk speakers. That is to say, me. That's at 7 p.m. Wednesday the 25th. New Vision United Church, American Sniper lectures. And of course, John Carlos, and we still have our fingers crossed we might reach John Carlos. He's going to be speaking March the 2nd, 1 week today, Innes College at 2 Sussex Drive at Toronto, 6:30 p.m. And he will speak and film Salute, marking the great moment in 1968 when the American athletes held up, black athletes held up their fists in solidarity with African Americans who were suffering repression. It was, and they called it exactly right for once, an iconic moment. And I can talk to people of every generation, and they have heard about John Carlos and Tommy Smith and Peter Norman. And we'll be taking up that matter. But I think we're joined now by Portia Karegeya. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Portia, thank you very much for talking to us. I wanted to CIUT listeners to remember that a little more than a year ago, your father was martyred in South Africa. And bring us up to date on this matter, because my understanding is that as yet there is no one in custody. Is that true?
Yes, that's true. The investigation portion is done, and basically the final touches for the judicial process to begin are underway. As far as I know, they've identified all the perpetrators. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, none of them are in the country. So we expect that it will probably be a very protracted, long process, because you would have to begin with extradition, which will likely be denied.
Yeah. This is, by the way, of course, one of the reasons I assume that we have this kind of slow-motion justice is that your father was a high-ranking former official in the Rwandan government. He had been a leader going all the way back to the days in Uganda, a very highly respected individual. And given the magnitude of the crime, governments get involved to make sure everything is, everybody says what they're going to have to live with in this. And I should mention, too, General Yamwasa was the victim of several attacks, almost lost his life, and he has achieved some justice in that there were people apprehended. Could you talk about his case in relation to your father?
Yes. Well, his case was concluded a few months ago, and they didn't manage to convict everybody, but they did get some convictions, and the determination of the court was favorable, although not to the extent that they would have wanted, of course. And I think they did mention that it seemed as though the government of Rwanda was somehow involved, but of course they couldn't state that, like, very explicitly and fully implicate them, because they only had the six people who are on trial before them. So,
That must give you and your family must take some heart from that.
Well, yes and no. I mean, we're disappointed in a way, because it's going to be a long, long, you know, drawn out process, and we would prefer closure sooner. But we can only continue to hope that the South African justice system will yield some good results for us. It's very difficult because none of the persons identified are actually in South Africa. Like, they haven't been apprehended. They are back in Rwanda, I think, most of them. So that's going to be difficult to deal with, yeah.
This is Portia Karagea. Her father was Colonel Patrick Karagea, and he was also former chief of intelligence in the Rwandan government. And I'm sure, and by the way, the world is pretty much convinced that that was the government of Rwanda did it. You want to talk about why you're convinced of that, or that's your feeling?
Well, because they had been pursuing him for years and years and years. He was persecuted in Rwanda. Thankfully, it wasn't, deadly at the time. Mm-hmm. And the reason he left was because he had been warned at the time he was released from prison that because he still seemed very defensive and not ready to kowtow to the government, that he would be taken care of permanently. So that's why he fled to begin with. It's very well known. And once he and his colleagues formed the RNC, like a formal opposition party, it was pretty much written in stone that your life is under threat now. So much that, the government is against you, but that you are a target for being killed.
It's very interesting. The severity and the ferocity that comes from a place that claims to recognize international law and to have an appropriate justice system. That the fact that your father, in front of the world, and together with others, formed a legal entity abroad, saying that they wished to see the change of government toward democracy in Rwanda, could be targeted for murder. Hello?
Yes.
I thought I'd lost you there. But isn't it? I mean, that's remarkable. What is the crime that he is? If you form a political movement, how can you be targeted for assassination?
Well, you would have to ask the Kagame regime about the exact logic behind that.
I guess I should do that. I'll call them.
Exactly. It's unconscionable. It's unconscionable to me. It's unconscionable to most of the developed, democratically developed world, or adherence to democracy anyway. It's a dictatorship. It's, you cannot oppose the current regime, and if you do, you might be killed. That's just how it goes.
Now, there was a quality to it that I think also people noticed 1 year ago, and that is that members of your family spoke up publicly, and they were exchanging messages, and somehow inadvertently, or I guess overtly, there was an exchange between members of your family and a minister of the government, and she was, that would be Miss Mushikababo. She was, I think she shocked even the United States State Department said, that's a little much. Can you tell us about that? And were you shocked when she did that?
I was incredibly shocked. But, two things, I was shocked because you just simply don't expect that in the immediate aftermath. I mean, I think it was about a day after he had been killed that somebody will speak. And it was to my brother, actually. She was speaking, and myself at some point. She was talking directly to the children of the deceased and telling us, well, he had it coming and he was a self-declared enemy and I have no sympathy for you people. It's shocking just in terms of normal human decency and, adult behavior. Like, you maybe don't speak to people who just lost their father that way. Mm-hmm. But on a different note, I think it's great just to have that on public record to show that this is the regime that we're working with and this is, the kind of diplomacy that you can expect from the minister. Well, lack of diplomacy, I guess. But
the lack. Yes.
So that's essentially what happened.
Yeah, you would think that the South African authorities, and I'll bet they did, take note of this because there was always the issue of who might have been behind these things. It becomes manifest that here is a party that seems to be threatening and is comfortable to be publicly talking about, this is a good thing.
Yes, exactly.
And subsequent to that, the president himself gave a speech which many of us have seen, and I would tell our listeners, if you go on the internet, you can watch. There are YouTubes of it, giving an equally ferocious and a sort of Hollywood-style villainy in the voice and the manners Speaking not only of your father and his allies, but just he said to anyone about what he would do.
I think it's been a while since I've watched that video, but essentially he said anybody who threatens the state, you know, Rwanda will, you know, be faced with the fiercest, you know, opposition, and they will never succeed.
Yeah, and by the way, and just to be clear, your father had not spoken in that manner towards the existing government. He did say that it should the government should go, that it was an oppressive government. But it wasn't this venomous, violence-encouraging kind of language.
No. I think they'd always kind of hoped for a... Well, I mean, I know that they hoped for a peaceful transition, whether that's to democracy, whether that is an actual possibility in the current climate. And, of course, well, with Kagame's methods, is I would say doubtful. Like, it doesn't seem that he will go quietly or that he would change his way of doing things suddenly. Mm-hmm. That's my opinion. Mm-hmm. But,
your family, having experienced what it has, would have a sense of who the character we are speaking of is. Now, by the way, he is facing a political crisis of his own in that his term, legal term in office, will be coming to an end fairly shortly. Can you talk about those abroad, those in exile who used to be close cohorts of his? Are they how are they assessing his government and also the prospects of uniting a movement to change Rwanda?
Well, they're continuing in their work. I mean, it's a struggle, but they do talk and they do coordinate and they do try to speak out more. And they because they are the opposition, they necessarily operate outside of the country and try to unite all the different diaspora who are politically active, because being politically active as well, whoever you are, is risky just for your safety in general as a Rwandan. Mm-hmm. So it's a few brave souls, and they're working hard. And I agree with you. I think 2017, which is when his term is up, will probably be a very definitive year in terms of what happens and to see what the future of Rwanda will be.
Yeah. We've seen governments in Africa, recently Burkina Faso, where a friend of Kagame's decided he was going to stay in office, and the people decided the otherwise.
Yeah, exactly.
And then there's the issue of his allies, who will have to deal with what he might choose to do. I mean, he has British allies, Americans. It won't look good if they encourage him to stay.
Yeah. I mean, it won't look good, but we'll have to see. I mean, there's not much more I can comment on that, but I know that I am sort of looking forward, I guess, to seeing what happens, because I think that moment will probably be the real moment when it will be more difficult to deny that he's some kind of magical, amazing leader who, you know, has done no wrong, basically.
Yes. Well, also, we certainly hope that now that as there's more scrutiny on Rwanda, that there will be the truth will come more rapidly to the surface in the case of your father. But just a last thing, could you just tell us briefly his kind of man he was in the post he held and how he's regarded by his friends?
As you said earlier, he was Director General of External Security for about 10 years. He tried to leave after 5 years, but they told him no, and he needed to find replacement, and then he was demoted and eventually arrested. And he was a wonderful man. Of course, he's my father. I have a generous amount of
certain
bias,
regard for him. Yes,
but he was very well respected. Upon his death, I received so many messages from a lot of important people from around the world, from all walks of life, just letting me know that they, you know, really thought that the world had lost a great man and someone who would have done great things had he been allowed to continue to live.
Yeah. Well, I'm really glad you gave us that portrait of him. I'm glad to know that your family is and all the his old allies are will pursue this to justice. Portia Karagea, we appreciate it very, very much.
Thank you. You're welcome. Bye.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye. Portia Karagea, her father was Colonel Patrick Karagea. I couldn't bring myself to mention during the interview that he was strangled to death on New Year's Eve 2013-2014, that there was a kind of celebration of it in Kigali. He had been one of their highest-ranking officials in that government. My memory of him was that he was a soft-spoken, approachable individual, and I'm not surprised that he had broken with the regime of Paul Kagame. You're listening to The Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and I'm going to remind you of a couple of things here. We weren't able to reach John Carlos today. He will be in town a week today, and he will be at Innes College at 6:30 p.m. on March the 2nd, and that's the town hall on 2 Sussex Drive. There, and there will be a film of Peter Norman, the great Australian sprinter, who is forgotten about sometimes in this issue in the matter of remembering Tommy Smith and John Carlos and the iconic moment at the Olympics in Mexico in 1968. But the film is about the three of them. And I have seen some clips, and you can find them, of course, on the net, of John Carlos remembering Peter Norman. And it is, I tell you, very, very, it's a very powerful story. And, of course, it at this time, this is Black History Month, the knowing that racism can be overcome and defeated, you know the story of these three figures, when we're seeing these events around Ferguson and the I Can't Breathe demonstrations in New York, joined in by major figures in the arts and in science and others have come forward, but imitating, in my opinion, the steps taken by those track stars at the Olympics in 1968. And again, I'll tell you, too, that Wednesday the 25th at 7 p.m. In Hamilton at 24 Main Street West, Zafar Bengash and myself are going to be talking about the movie American Sniper. It didn't win an Academy Award, I understand, and I'm not going to give it one now and nor in the future, but it deserves a special attention because of what it the hazard it represents, the influence. It's often pointed out, you know, you want to get a kid who's just out of finishing high school, he doesn't have a job, and he's thinking what to do with himself. The recruiters come along with their movies and say, well, look at John Wayne. You want to be like him, and you want to be like these other guys. And The Sniper does that, in my opinion. There is a trial, by the way, that is winding up in Texas of the man. His name is Eddie Ray Raut. And Eddie Ray Raut went to a gun range, rifle range, with The Sniper and The Sniper's good friend in a Ford F-350 truck. And they went there for therapy for this troubled ex-Marine, Mr. Raut. It's come to light that Chris Kyle of The Sniper was not a qualified therapist. And it is, I think, probably the minority school of therapists would recommend taking someone with who's been in and out of a veterans hospital for mental problems to a rifle range. But they did go, and on February 2nd, 2013, Eddie Ray Raut shot both Chad Littlefield and Chris Kyle. The trial has lasted a mere 2 weeks. It's a very curious trial. It was postponed today. It'd probably go to the jury tomorrow, they're having an ice storm now in around the Dallas area where this trial is taking place. I'm giving you your weather report in case you're going to Dallas. And the judge put off the going to the jury. It's expected that the jury will probably take about 22 minutes, maybe three. It's not an issue of did he do it. The issue is did he do it with criminal knowledge, I think. I think I might be fudging the argument a bit. Of course, the defense argued that he was mentally troubled and not fully aware of what he was doing. And the prosecution argues he knew enough, therefore. But what are we talking about? We're talking about a life sentence in prison, or we're talking about a life sentence in a mental institution? Incidentally, I hate to say this, but you always want to think of the financial aspect. If he's criminally guilty, then they don't have to pay him his compensation. He gets compensation. It was awarded to him after he shot Mr. Kyle. Because the Army, who hadn't made up their mind, their hospital suddenly made up their mind and said, yes, you have PTSD. At the trial, the Kyle people argued that he didn't have PTSD, that he was merely something else. The quote of the whole trial comes to us from Chris Kyle, who texted in to his partner while they're driving toward the rifle range. He texted to Mr. Littlefield, "This dude is straight up nuts." And then Mr. Littlefield responded also with a text, "He's sitting behind me. Watch my back." And then they proceeded, the two of them, pardon me, the three. There was a man sitting behind them. Next to him on the truck seat was a box full of guns. And Mr. Rout was suffering from paranoia. And in his, the psychologist who interviewed him said Mr. Rout didn't like it when people didn't talk to him, and he didn't like it when they didn't shake hands. And according to the evidence that they gave to the court, neither man shook his hand and neither man spoke to him, and he was sitting behind them in a truck with a bunch of guns. So we'll bring you up to date on the trial later. Hamilton Wednesday, the 25th, 7 p.m., Zafar Bengash and myself are talking about this subject. This is Phil Tater for the Tater Report, and we'll see you next week.